James Balog is the author of 9 books, an award-winning filmmaker, and a one-time avid mountaineer. His 2018 documentary, The Human Element, screened worldwide, including at Mountain Film. James is, in fact, a Mountain Film regular, having first presented in Telluride in the 1990s, then returning to show his spectacular photographs and eco-focused documentary projects, all endeavoring to move the needle on key issues facing our planet. James returns this year with his latest creative venture, an epic titled The Human Element, a time capsule from the Anthropocene. The book explores the impact of wildfires, hurricanes, sea level rise, a struggling coal mining community, and our changing air. With rare compassion and heart, The Human Element also highlights Americans on the front lines of climate change, inspiring us all to reevaluate our relationship with the natural world. This is Susan Vibrock, Telluride Inside and Out, honored to be speaking with James Balog, who is widely considered one of the most important and relevant photographers in the world today. James, thanks for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, Susan. It's nice to visit again.
Yes, I agree. So in your award-winning 2018 documentary, titled the same as your recent magnum opus, The Human Element, you stated that you wanted to celebrate the elegance and beauty of nature, but soon realized there was a much more complex story going on in the world about the collision between people and Mother Nature, and that you felt a great sense of urgency to bear witness to that. How has your photography evolved and changed over 40 years in the face of that realization?
I was fairly typical nature-oriented photographer in the beginning. You know, when I picked up a camera, I was just trying to celebrate the grandeur of the places I was climbing and the beauty of the things I was seeing. And frankly, I still like to do that today, but I consider that my more essential or vital or central work is, as you were saying just a little while ago, about this collision between humanity and the rest of nature. So that whole effort started in about 1981, and it has evolved into many different forms over the years. Back in my earliest days as a photographer, I was very, very influenced by a lot of the classical documentary photography that was oriented around war, poverty, famine, and the disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been some great, great bodies of work done, especially around war photography. But it occurred to me that there was this war or warlike activity going on inadvertently between people and nature, and that virtually nobody was doing it. And I realized that that was an enormous potential field of exploration visually, and that was something that really spoke to me, and it was something I wanted to focus on for the rest of my working career. So here we are, 40 years later.
Okay. Thank you. How did the film, The Human Element, which captures the lives of everyday Americans on the front lines of environmental change, how did that inspire your 2021 tome, The Human Element, a time capsule from the Anthropocene?
You know, it's a funny thing about a lot of this creative work. You think you know where you're going. And fortunately, 40 years ago, I had an idea about the big theme I wanted to cover. A lot of the details in between have been a mystery to me as to how they evolve and how they connect. When we did the 2018 film, I thought that was the end of the idea of the human element. And then as we were designing this new book that's more or less a retrospective of all of this thinking about this subject, we were thrashing around with some titles over the course of a couple months, and I think we had some pretty good titles. But one day my publisher called me and said, you know what, I think we ought to call it The Human Element. I love the I love the subtitle he said, which is the subtitle we always had, a time capsule from the Anthropocene. But he said, look, just call it the human element. That's kind of been the center of your thinking forever, maybe, and it ties to the film. And just keep the whole concept unified. And so we did.
Okay, thank you. So the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. Modern humans have been around for a mere 200,000 years, but over the past 120 years in particular, human impacts have unfolded at an unprecedented rate and scale in a period now sometimes known as the Great Acceleration. Carbon emissions, global warming, ocean acidification, habitat destruction, species extinction, and the extraction of wide-scale natural resources are all signs that we've significantly modified our planet. That's what gives rise to the word Anthropocene, the new term for our current geologic epoch. Do you think Homo sapiens' impact on these Earth systems, on the environment, on processes and biodiversity are irreversible, or do you remain guardedly optimistic? If you do, why?
Let me come back to the irreversible and guardedly optimistic question. And if I get too far off on a tangent, I hope you'll pull me back. I have come to the realization over the years, and as I had to put these thoughts onto paper, particularly for this book, that my old thinking about the collision between humans and nature implied that we were separate. And that language and that thinking goes back thousands of years, maybe forever, for all I know. But it certainly has been part of the Western tradition for a long time, that nature is some place that's not us. Mm-hmm. And when you fully grasp what the Anthropocene idea means, you realize that we are an integral element in the natural system. We're not separate from it. And so just as with earth, air, fire, water, plants, and animals, the human element is an element of nature. That's the essential point. And the realization that comes as a corollary from that is as we damage nature, we damage ourselves. As we damage that supposedly external thing that we characterize as nature, we're actually damaging ourselves. And I believe that that realization is absolutely at the center of what we need to achieve and grasp and get if we are to find ourselves to a sustainable future. So, do I think it's irreversible, the problems we have? Am I guardedly optimistic or not? I don't think that the damages are irreversible. Actually, sorry, let me say some of the damages obviously are, or they're only reversible over large periods of time beyond our comprehension. The reshaping of the land surfaces that we've done for agriculture and mining, that's multiple million year revisions that nature would have to do if we just suddenly ejected off into outer space and nature was left to its own devices. And here I am talking about nature again. I'm talking about if the rest of the Earth elements were left to their own devices, it would take a long time to fix these things. But an awful lot of the more immediate front and center well-known issues are reversible if we focus on them well enough. Overfishing doesn't have to be overfishing. Climate change, because we're damaging the air supply, doesn't need to be always changing. We don't always need to have a damaged air supply. We don't always need to be amping up the weather cycles that lead to dangerous storms or more dangerous severe storms and sea level rise. There is a path forward. And practically enough, we know what to do. There are shelves and shelves and shelves and websites and online research counting in the, you know, millions and millions of words describing what the way out of this bottleneck is. And we know what to do. We just have to muster the social, psychological, political, financial will to do it. We have the technology to make improvements. We just have to do it. And some states, cities, and countries are doing it better than other ones are. And as we all know, for the moment, the national political system here in the United States, that that big white building up on Capitol Hill, is basically hamstrung by the character and structure of the legislative system we have. And that is really unfortunate, because we're burning up the years right now at the same time we're burning up the climate.
Thank you for that, as you said, fulsome answer. So back to the book. The Human Element contains your provocative essays and 350 of your most iconic photographs. This magnum opus offers an unmatched view of the world and what you sum up as human tectonics, or humanity's reshaping of the natural environment, again with this us and them sort of bent. Beyond simply bearing witness and documenting through your work, please talk about how those environments, those environmental impacts, have impacted you personally. Talk about your close encounters with glaciers, rising sea levels, wildfires. Didn't your house in the footlands of the Rockies nearly burn down? Talk about fossil fuels. Didn't your grandfather mine coal? So let's make it personal.
Yeah. Well, there's so many dimensions of this story that are very, very personal. In very long, old, unexpected ways, and then in very new and immediate ways. I'll go back to the very first, or the very last thing you said, which happens to be the very first influence that probably has affected so much of this work. Yeah, my grandfather, my father's father, was a coal miner digging coal in western Pennsylvania. And the grandfather and great-grandfather on my mother's side were both in the coal industry. One is a truck driver, one is an underground miner. And my father's father was killed in a coal mine collapse 6 years before I was born.
Wow.
Sorry, I get a little choked up when I talk about that.
Of course.
The story of coal became embedded in my life because of that family history and because of the once a summer trips we would make to those little towns out in the hills to see where the families had been. And the smell of what was still the burning coal underground, and the sight of those tailings piles and the piles of coal laying around and the mine trestles and all that stuff was still there when I was a young boy. All those influences just sat there with nothing to do until we worked on the Human Element film. And we were shooting there in western Pennsylvania and in the coal mining country in eastern Kentucky in 2016. And I really, for some weird reason, maybe not so weird, I felt like I had come home again, and I was back in those old inherited ancestral places, and I was addressing that stuff. And then I realized that we all need to address these dimensions of how we are connected to the system that so many of us in environmental land spend so much time criticizing. We are all tied to this system. You cannot avoid it. You and I are speaking right now on a telephone line that's powered by electricity. And even though I've got solar panels on my roof and I click the little box on the Excel bill to say I want to support renewable energy, I'm still the beneficiary of electrons coming from a coal-fired power plant out to the east of here in Boulder. And all of our fancy fleece jackets and our cool shoes and the cars we drive and all of this, we are in it. We, the human element, are part of this. You cannot avoid it. And the sooner we get that through our thick heads, the sooner I think the left green movement, which I consider myself a part of, will play a more functional role in the society. And I'll try and keep it short here on the rest of it. Yes, my home in the foothills of the Rockies here above Boulder nearly burned down some years ago in a bad fire. And that's a lot of what got me to thinking about, man, I better deal with fire photographically one of these days. The glaciers came out of a lifelong love of high mountains and a lot of the trips I had done in Alaska and the Alps and so forth. And then, you know, I also knew 20 plus years ago, more than 20 years, I needed to deal with climate change because I was so focused on environmental photography. And I could not figure out a way to photograph climate change and all the different things I sniffed around on. And I eventually realized that about the only thing I could do would be with ice and glaciers. At first, that seemed like a dumb idea because I thought, oh, what does that mean? Penguins? You know, that's the living thing that's good with ice because ice is so dead and static, right? I can't do anything with ice, so it's got to be penguins. Then I thought, oh, that's dumb. You know, the penguin pictures all kind of look alike, as beautiful as they can be, and I've shot a whole bunch of those myself. But one day I got a phone call from the New Yorker magazine in 2005. And long story short, they wanted me to go to Iceland to photograph receding glaciers. And when I was in Iceland, discovered that there was a certain characteristic of the termini of some of these glaciers that really spoke to the question of recession and the mortality of those glaciers as a consequence of climate change. And nothing's been the same since. That was 2005. I'm still working on climate change, and I'm actually going back to Iceland to photograph some of those same glaciers before I get to mountain film this year.
Okay. Thank you for that. And another question involves a way you've described yourself, which is as a detective. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, the photographic process for me has been for years a sniffing around. You know, I feel like I'm out there with a magnifying glass, you know, like an old Sherlock Holmes movie, and I'm sniffing around looking for the evidence, the clues that will lead me down a creative path. I'll get a big idea in my head about the general thing that I'm interested in doing. Something kind of vibrates in my gut. And I think, oh, man, that's an interesting idea, but oh, I don't know how to do it. So then I have to go and get out the magnifying glass and learn more and look around more and sniff this way and sniff that way, back and forth, and try things, experiment with things until I finally find the path forward. But it all starts with that detective sniffing around process.
Okay. Thank you. In his first heavily celebrated book, Sapiens, Yuval Noah Harari contends that progress is basically an illusion, and that Sapiens' regime on Earth has so far produced little we can be proud of. In light of the destruction you've witnessed and documented, do you agree with Harari's contention?
I disagree. Certainly we have a lot to be remorseful about. But fundamentally, I think there's a lot that we can be proud of. We have beautiful buildings, and we have beautiful sculptures, and we have beautiful pyramids, and we have found in many places constructive ways to live with the bounty of the world that's around us. If you take an extreme view and say, well, you know, we don't deserve to belong to this planet, then you get to Harari's idea, as you've expressed it. And I just disagree with that. I think that's counterproductive, and I think it's pointless. It's a pointless concern.
Thank you. Let's get personal again. So this is my final question. In what ways did your young life inform your professional path and the work you've done over the past four decades? Your compelling, unsettling, visually stunning celluloid and printed images. A certain cognitive dissonance arises when we learn that the man behind the camera was a hunter during his teens.
Yeah, well, the early life question, as I said, starts with that that coal mining story. And yeah, in my teens, I was kind of fixated on hunting. Back at that time, the only adults that I had contact with who were interested in nature were hunters. It was my uncle out in the hills of Pennsylvania, and it was my my neighbor's father across the street. And through hunting is how I learned that you could touch the magic of these animals that were running around out in the forest. And I was, you know, I was deeply interested in nature. I spent a lot of time camping and shuffling through the woods and collecting leaves and collecting snakes and collecting rocks and climbing in trees and sitting up in treetops for hours in the wind. I loved all that, but it was hunting where this act of killing gave me a chance to touch the beautiful feathers of a pheasant or the skin of a deer. Now I look back on that and I think, oh, that's pretty dark and pretty contrary. And indeed it is. And I realized that one day when I was 18 years old and I happened to shoot a rabbit that was running past me with a, and I was shooting with a bow and arrow. And I made the kind of shot that hunters would say was perfect. It went right through the right spot of the animal. And but that poor thing laid there screaming, the most horrible scream as it died. And I put the bow and arrow down, I put the guns down, I never shot another thing again because I realized how stupid the activity was. And I realized that I had to seek a different path. And that different path opened up just that same summer when I had a chance to hike around in the Colorado Rockies for 3 weeks on a Colorado Outward Bound course. And that reset the path of my life. You know, it was just about being up on those high ridges in the wind and looking at the incredible landscape and looking at the wildflowers blossoming and the waterfalls falling. And that was life moving forward, and it still is.
Thank you. This has been Susan Zebrock talking with James Balog, who will be returning to Mountain Film, thankfully, for the 2022 in-person event. James, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. I look forward to seeing you, Susan, and seeing Telluride again and seeing the gang. So I think I'm supposed to be at High Camp, and I'll look forward to that.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.